From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll examine how a shortage of primary care providers impacts both patients and doctors. Then, Capital Notes looks ahead to the Republican state political convention this weekend.
A little bit of party business that's conducted, a little bit of kind of, you know, seeing old friends, a little bit of a pep rally. So it is just a little more of a high profile thing in election year because of what's at stake, you know, 5 months later.
Plus, in this week's Bubbler Talk, we'll learn about engravings found along Brady Street in Milwaukee.
The images are so interesting, and that's what wanted me to reach out to you, is that they were like a mystery.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Have you ever noticed the engravings in the concrete along Brady Street? We'll explore those in Bubbler Talk later in the show. We'll start with this. When was the last time you visited your primary care provider? Think about how long it takes to schedule an appointment. And once you're there, did you feel rushed during the visit? Have these factors led you to hesitate to return or even want to find a new provider? These experiences with healthcare access and doctors are common, and an unfortunate side effect of a shortage of primary care physicians. With primary care providers leaving the medical field, it forces clinicians to treat more patients in less time, leading to less than ideal or unreliable care. This problem is prevalent not only in the Milwaukee area, but nationwide. Freelance reporter Ashley Abramson wrote about this issue in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and she joins me now to share more about the primary care shortage. Hey, Ashley, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
So this is a big problem, not just impacting Milwaukee, but far beyond across the nation, and more primary care providers are leaving the medical field, which forces clinicians that remain to treat more patients in less time. So with this issue becoming more and more prevalent, what are the consequences for both patients and for the providers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's a lot of factors at play. I think the obvious answer is that finding a primary care doctor is harder. Whether you move, you know, to the area and you're looking for a provider for yourself and your family, or you're not happy with your doctor and you want to switch, or your doctor leaves and you need to find a new one, all of those things can become more difficult. There can be really long wait lists, and some people might not feel like they can wait that long to find a doctor or see a doctor. I think appointments can be rushed when there's fewer providers available. There's less time slotted for each patient, which means patients might not feel like they can ask all the questions they have for their physicians. And with that, I think doctors, even well-meaning providers who are passionate about providing great care, might feel rushed and might not be able to take the measures they normally take to provide that excellent level of care, which practically might look like, you know, making a patient feel rushed, creating kind of an anxious, frenzied environment where people feel like they can't share things with their doctor, or on the more extreme end, potentially, you know, over-prescribing and just writing that prescription to kind of end the appointment and keep moving. So I'd say that there are definitely high-level effects in terms of how this affects public health, but also, you know, on the other level, people leave appointments feeling anxious and upset, and doctors might feel less satisfied with their jobs because they have less time to be the great doctor that they want to be.
So these are a lot of the negative effects we can all feel and probably have experienced ourselves. But in an ideal world, you know, pretending this problem doesn't exist, what effect does having a good and reliable primary care provider have for an individual, not just for that day of the appointment?
Yeah, I think, you know, like we talked about, on the day of the appointment, when you like your doctor and you don't feel rushed, you're more likely to open up and share things. And then the doctor can, you know, respond in kind and help you with the things that you want help with. I think that a good and reliable relationship with a primary care provider is a lot about prevention as well, not just managing the symptoms that do come up or the conditions that pop up, but making sure you're on top of your vaccines, getting all those screenings that we need to prevent things like high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure. And a lot of the relationship with the primary care physician is education, right? Like learning about things like nutrition and mental health and exercise and sleep habits and how all of those things can help us live healthier lives and, you know, prevent disease from occurring in the first place. So if we don't have a PCP, we're going to miss out on some of those things. And I could see that really affecting people's health negatively.
So naturally, in any field, some turnover is to be expected, right? Like people retire, they move, et cetera. But with doctor turnover rates, this has escalated. So what factors have complicated or led to this larger turnover that will eventually lead us here in the U.S. to be short over 45,000 primary care providers in 10 years?
Yeah, it's such a concerning issue. I think, you know, like you said, retirement and leaving a job or moving are totally normal. But as we're seeing in so many different fields, you know, burnout is hugely prevalent in the medical field, which I think doctors that are burned out and unhappy might want to retire earlier. And I think on the other side, more and more doctors in training are choosing to go into specialties rather than primary care, like dermatology or oncology or surgery, simply because those specialties are higher paying and often, you know, better hours with different kinds of demands that might prevent that kind of same type of burnout from happening. I think, you know, we've all watched the medical shows, Grey's Anatomy and things like that. And I think there's some truth to what we see that, you know, these resident doctors that are working 80 hours a week and getting paid, you know, peanuts, they're getting burned out on the front end too. So, and we're seeing it, I've heard, as early as, you know, medical school. So I think the burnout is definitely a huge component driving this issue.
You mentioned a lot of med students going into specialties because the reality is they will make more money versus primary care. And medical school debt plays a factor into this choice as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I don't have any exact numbers in front of me, but I know that these students that go to medical school are not only burdened with their undergraduate debt, but then the medical school debt on top of that is just insurmountable for so many folks. And when we think about, you know, the Medicare reimbursement rates declining, they're faced with like, is it really worth it? Do I want to take on all of this debt and then have years of this burden, interest accumulating with the residency not paying well? It's going to be a long time until they can actually, you know, possibly even touch that debt. So that's definitely a factor.
Now, you know, we're not generalizing doctors here, and we are recognizing that they're working in a difficult system, right? So I want to talk about that too. Like, no matter how much care a doctor might want to give you, they are probably feeling rushed as well, and in turn passing that on to their patients. So what roles do the systems that they operate within have with this shortage? You know, for example, whether it's the healthcare environment, their employer they're operating under, or insurance practices?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think like any societal problem, there are some deeply embedded societal issues and multiple at play. I think healthcare environments can be stressful, you know, for-profit environments where providers might feel rushed, like they have to see a certain number of patients each day, which might make them feel rushed and not providing the type of care they want to see. And, you know, we know that when the job satisfaction goes down, the risk of burnout goes up. And with that can come things like, you know, depression type symptoms that make it really hard to function in that environment. I think that the insurance requirements can be a huge burden. Doctors are tasked with not only, you know, seeing the patients, but behind the scenes, so much charting and coding and paperwork that can make the day feel really stressful. And then, as I outlined in the article, some of the Medicare reimbursement rates. So, you know, doctors who are seeing older patients or people covered by Medicare, these rates are also declining, which can just honestly make the work feel unfair and less rewarding.
Now, you yourself participate in a direct primary care system, which is outside some of the systems we've been talking about. So can you explain what that is and how this works?
Yes. So direct primary care is a lot of different things for me and for patients who choose this route. It means having more access to your doctor without, you know, the medical systems that we all know in the area involved. So a lot of doctors will go the private practice route and choose not to bill insurance. And when you don't bill insurance, you know, there's two sides of the coin. Direct care patients have to pay a monthly fee rather than having their insurance cover the care. But because of that, there is less of a barrier to seeing your doctor and getting the care you need. For example, I'm able to message my doctor and get an answer the same day. I can text him or call him and hear back on a concern that I have and get an appointment the same day, where in other healthcare settings, you might have to wait days or weeks for that kind of response or appointment follow-up. And I think it's definitely a privilege to be able to participate in a care model like that. These doctors see fewer patients because they're making more money from the private pay component. But with that, you also get more attention and, I think, in many cases, better care. So that's definitely an option. There's several direct care models in the area, and you can use your HSA to pay for it. And a lot of times it ends up being a pretty comparable cost depending on how you use the care.
In addition to some private care system routes, there are some calls to actions and other things being implemented within some local healthcare systems here. So what kind of calls to action are being made by doctors or healthcare systems to help alleviate this problem that they're facing?
Great, great question, and really important to address. I think there's a lot being done on the local and national levels. I know that there are a lot of advocacy organizations that are lobbying and advocating for, you know, those better Medicare pay rates, and advocating for cheaper med school and more options for students to attend med school without that burden of debt. There are also a lot of exciting things happening locally. I know that Frederick and Medical College of Wisconsin are collaborating with some local clinics to train primary care doctors. So when we see these clinics in healthcare deserts and areas of, you know, pretty significant healthcare inequity, when we're training family medicine providers, residents in those spaces, we're addressing two problems. We're addressing the systemic inequities there, and we're also training more healthcare providers that we hope will stay in the area and offer more options for folks who need a PCP.
So you also include some helpful like guides, levels of care that exists and options people have for choosing a PCP. But, you know, ultimately this kind of reminded me of the unfortunate reality of like, it's important for you to be your own medical advocate. And a lot of people don't have the tools to know this, right? Or until they're facing a health emergency and they have to like have a crash course in this. So, you know, what did you learn from this story and the importance of not just recognizing the flaws of the system, but recognizing like, you got to be on top of this for yourself?
Totally. So I think it's really important to be aware of your options if you don't have a reliable primary care doctor, that things like urgent care and the emergency department can be appropriate for certain concerns, but establishing a relationship ultimately with a provider that can see you long-term and know your health history, someone that you trust and actually like, is super important. And it might take some time and some work to do that. You can, you know, call your insurance provider and ask them what your options are. You can call clinics and find out who has openings. I think asking around your network of friends to see who they like, you know, asking friends and family for referrals of who they like and who they see can be helpful. And then just knowing your options and knowing that, you know, the direct care route might be a better option for some folks, depending on what their priorities are. And ultimately, you know, advocating for yourself and doing the work to find a provider that you'd like and trust, because no one else will do that for you.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for joining me today to share more about the primary care shortage here.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley Abramson is a freelance reporter with Milwaukee Magazine. You can find her full article about the primary care shortage in this month's issue.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver. Wisconsin Republicans are gearing up for their state political convention this weekend. J.R. Ross is here to explain why that's important this election year. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here. We've got an early edition Capital Notes this week.
No, thanks for having me.
All right. So the Republican National Convention is coming up. It'll be held in Milwaukee. A lot of people know about that. And that's getting a lot of attention locally. States also have conventions. The Wisconsin GOP's is coming up this weekend, and Wisconsin Democrats will hold theirs in the beginning of June. Starting off, what happens at a state convention?
Well, there are a couple of things to watch this week in the Republicans. One, they will go through the endorsement process in the U.S. Senate, which will be a formality, really. Eric Hovde is the only person who qualified. The party set a requirement that you had to raise $1 million from, I believe, some thousands of donors by the end of March to qualify. Hovde's the only one who met that mark, so the one eligible. Two, there will be a vote on the National Committee Man and National Committee Woman. Wisconsin has three members of the Republican National Committee. Two are elected at convention every 2 years. The third is reserved for the state chair. It'll be interesting to watch those votes to see who gets in one and two, what direction the party is going. For example, in the National Committee Woman race, you have a woman who's been, Mary Pat Kruger, has been a longtime Republican activist, kind of a traditional Republican in that sense, and that always been around the party, always been involved. Then you have the vice chair of the Dane County Republican Party running as kind of a more of the Trumpier Turning Point USA type candidate. And there's an effort by Turning Point USA, which is this pro-Trump group, to try and get toeholds in parties around the country to take the national committee in more of a Trumpy direction. So which direction do the state activists want to go? That's a big thing. And then thirdly, you know, these are kind of rallies. They're trying to get the troops fired up ahead of what's going to be a long 5.5 months. You know, there are going to be calls to make, yard signs to put out, doors to knock on. This is a chance for the activists to get together and kind of get that kind of pep rally going, raise their spirits for the fight ahead.
And how are Republicans going to divide their time this year? Is it more important for them, for instance, to push for the GOP presidential presumptive nominee Donald Trump's reelection, unseat U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, or perhaps hold on to state legislative seats because of redistricting? How are you hearing Republicans will spend their time and money with these competing priorities?
Oh, they're going to. A convention is going to be a number of speeches. You'll hear from state lawmakers. You'll hear from members of the congressional delegation. You'll hear from Eric Hovde, the state party chair. So they're not really kind of hinting at their priorities this weekend. Everybody's going to see the table. The keynote speaker is a Trump surrogate. Byron Donald's a congressman from Florida. So they're going to cover all their bases this weekend. And again, it's kind of a pep rally / messaging weekend. And they're looking for a positive message delivered through the media about what their vision is for the next couple to 4 years.
And you know that there's a lot of talk about gaps in Wisconsin between urban and rural areas. How are Republicans this year at the convention, you know, kind of balancing the strong support for Trump in rural areas with what's happening in the more urban areas?
It's not so much a convention question as an infrastructure question for them, which I mean by that is opening offices, getting staffers on the ground. When Joe Biden was in town in the state last week, his campaign was talking about how he had, you know, 44 offices opened in Wisconsin, 80 staffers on the ground between the campaign. It's called the Democratic Coordinating Campaign. Republicans aren't really there yet. They're still getting stuff organized. There's been a lot of shots taken at Republicans for closing, for example, a minority outreach office in Milwaukee. So really for Republicans, more about that. That's the bigger question, not convention, but how do they build that infrastructure, the resources to do it, and when they get it in place? Because the Democrats have a head start, but when you look at the polls, it shows that Donald Trump has a bit of an edge over Joe Biden in Wisconsin, however slight it might be. But infrastructure helps you deliver results. It doesn't really change the trajectory of a race, but if it's a 50-50 race, whoever has the best infrastructure can sometimes pull out the win.
And you've reported at WisPolitics that there's the fundraising gap between state Republicans and the Wisconsin mm-hmm. Democratic Party, which outraised it 15-1 in the first quarter of 2024. Is a convention one tool to turn that around?
Not really. More of those are kind of the responsibility of the state chair and the big wigs, essentially, of connecting and getting those big checks to come in. The state Democratic Party's done a better job of connecting with people and write big checks, especially from out of state. And there's been a push from some Republicans in the party to say, okay, we need to catch up. Yeah, we knock Democrats for going to California for cash, but there are Republican donors in California too, and Illinois and New York. We need to tap into those donors and try and boost our resources, because as one member argued in a memo a few weeks ago, they're falling behind. And without money, there's no infrastructure, there's no operation, no money, no message, or no mission. And there's going to be competition for dollars this year in Wisconsin among conservatives because you have the national convention in town. You got to raise money for that. Eric Hovey's raising money for a Senate race. You have kind of some intense contests for the legislature and the assembly and the Senate. There's a lot of competition for in-state donors, and you run the risk if you're the party of, you know, going to people who are already tapped out if you don't look at those out-of-state folks and try and bring more money in.
And does the state convention have a different sort of importance during a presidential election year like this?
A little bit. It's a little, you know, there's a little bit of party business that's conducted, a little bit of kind of, you know, seeing old friends, a little bit of a pep rally. So it is just a little more of a high profile thing in election year because of what's at stake, you know, 5 months later.
And you've, JR, covered these conventions in the past. What have you found to be the most illuminating or the most interesting?
Well, I'm kind of weird about conventions. I enjoy the debate about resolutions. These are like the party activists have these debates that are very, very intense about very, very deeply personal issues that don't really matter a lot to the general public at large, but it tells you where the base is at sometimes. I've often said that of watching both parties' delegates and activists have these debates, I realize that the political spectrum is not like a half circle. It's a smiley face because at the end, the very extremes meet down below at the bottom. They have similar suspicions about the federal government, that kind of thing. So it's interesting to watch those. But really, for the party, they want to have this be a messaging thing. They want to try to highlight their best and deliver a message about how they're behind Donald Trump. They're behind Eric Hovde. They're going to fight for to maintain control of the legislature and keep people like Derek Van Orden, their congressional district, who's being targeted, and Brian Stile in the first. So it's really about, again, you know, message and juicing up the base and getting them going for the fall.
You're tuned in to Capital Notes. I'm WWM's Mayan Silver speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Okay, so we'll turn the corner a second to let people know what's going on in the state legislature. The regular floor period where they take up new bills is done for the year. Legislators are focusing on their campaigns for reelection, but the state Senate met on Tuesday to take up veto overrides. First, before we get into what happened Tuesday, can you remind people what a veto override is and how they work in Wisconsin?
Sure. To override the governor's veto, you have to have a two-thirds vote of those present in both houses of the legislature. In the Senate, Republicans have a supermajority, 22 to 10 right now. In the Assembly, they don't. They're two votes short. So that means that Republicans, to override a veto of Governor Evers, would need to have all Republicans stay together and get two Democrats to support the override to be successful. No veto has been overridden since 1985. It's not a very common occurrence. And part of it is, you know, it's hard to get bipartisan buy-in to an override. Typically, if you're a Republican and the governor's a Republican, you sustain his veto. And same for Democrats. If the person in the East Wing is a Dem and you're a Democratic lawmaker, you support his or her veto because it's party discipline and kind of expected of you.
So what happened on Tuesday was that the Senate sort of plowed through the eight veto override votes largely without incident. But Republican leaders then rejected a move by Democrats to bring five assembly bills to the floor for votes, mm-hmm. including one that would allow the processing of absentee ballots the day before an election. Can you tell us what's happening here?
Sure. So as they went through these veto overrides, Democrats wanted to make sure they had an opportunity for this motion to bring up five bills. They included things like making a Class C felony for a therapist to have sex with a client, property tax break for veterans, the early processing bill. They wanted to get votes on those because they thought they were important bills. One and two, they also put some Republicans in an uncomfortable position because if you're voting against those things, you know, they can up an ad sometimes because they can say, hey, this person's so extreme, they opposed X, Y, and Z. So they proposed this motion on the floor to bring up the votes. It was rejected. And then they went back to the overrides. And, you know, Democrats weren't happy. They argued these are bipartisan bills. But it's rare, if ever, that I see the minority party succeed and trying to bring a bill up from committee or that it wasn't scheduled for the calendar for a vote on the floor.
So is there any hope for processing absentee ballots the day before the election for the 2024 election?
Miracles do happen, but I wouldn't count on that one in Wisconsin before this fall. There are several Republican lawmakers in the Senate who are opposed to it. And in talking to some of them, they've told me flat out that, look, people in some of these districts are convinced that there's something going amiss in Milwaukee with absentee ballots, that you know, these Democrats are up to no good. And their constituents believe falsely that if you can process these ballots, say before, you will actually start counting them, which would be part of the bill. And then these clerks would tell local activists for Democrats, hey, you're short of your target number in Ward X or whatnot. And they'd go out there and try and get more people to vote, or there'd be some funny business. And they're unhappy about it. And so the Republicans have told me that it's not worth the grief they would get from constituents and their base back home to vote for that bill. So without a better argument or about convincing those folks of the need for it, it's not going to go anywhere, because Republicans do have that supermajority, but there are enough Republicans who are unhappy about the bill that they don't have 17 votes in the GOP caucus right now, as I can tell, to pass the bill. And while it would probably pass with all Democratic support and probably most of the Republicans, Republicans typically have a rule that they stick by, or guide, that they want to have 17 votes from the GOP caucus alone to pass a bill. It basically guarantees that the majority is pushing that bill through, the majority party, without the help of the minority. When you start passing bills without 17 votes in the Republican caucus, it can cause you issues as a leader, because then some of your members aren't happy because they're not being heard. It's not a hard, fast rule, but it's been one that's been enforced more often than not in my time covering the state Senate.
Well, meanwhile, the city of Milwaukee has a central count for its election, which means that they take all these absentee ballots and they have to count them all in the same place, and they can't process them until the day of the election. And so people get upset that there's some sort of a quote unquote ballot dump when they find that all these votes have been counted later on an election night.
Yeah, that's what Donald Trump brought up in 2020. It was not a ballot dump. It just takes a while to count them. I remember in August of 2020 being up until, I think, like 3:30 a.m. awaiting the absentee ballot count from Milwaukee. I knew at that moment that I was going to end for a long night in November, because if they took until 3:30 counting ballots for primaries, when the turnout was much, much higher for the general election, it was going to be a long night into an early morning, and it was. But, you know, the argument from Republicans has become, well, they should stop central count. It's not about the bill or processing. It's about doing it better, and they should do what Madison does, which Madison takes your absentee ballots and sends them out to the wards where voting is going on, and then the poll workers in those wards feed those ballots through the machines during the day. When times are slow, they'll go through those envelopes, open them up, process them, and pop them in the machine, have them counted. It works in Madison. Others argue that's a better process to have a central count in some communities, and that's what we have. And so without Milwaukee changing that process, which is not going to happen, it's going to be a late night, probably November. Although I will point out, we are not voting as heavily absentee as we used to. 3.3 million people voted in November of 2020. There are almost 2 million absentee ballots. We're not going to see that number again in 2024, barring something crazy happening. Turnout probably is not going to get 3.3 million. People tell me because voters aren't excited about Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, part two. And two, we're voting more normal, quote unquote normal. People are going to the polls again in higher numbers than they did in 2020 without the pandemic going on. So we're not going to see that kind of a crush of absentee ballots in Milwaukee in 2024 that we saw in 2020, if expectations hold where we're at right now.
Yeah, that's good context to have. Well, thanks for being our eyes and ears on the state capitol and on state politics, JR. And thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
That was WUWM's Mayon Silver speaking with J.R. Ross of WISP Politics ahead of the Republican State Political Convention. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link to that at WUWM.com. And what you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn about the work being done at the National Weather Service in Sullivan, Wisconsin. But first, the latest episode of WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union, explores the history of unions in Wisconsin. We'll learn about that and hear a bit of the podcast coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Deindustrialization, or the process of transitioning out of an industrial economy, once defined life in southeastern Wisconsin. Milwaukee was once known as the factory floor of the world, and surrounding cities were built up around these same industries, like Kenosha. The latest episode of our new podcast, Swing State of the Union, explores Wisconsin's labor history and what happened in Kenosha. The full show can be heard tomorrow at noon, but before that, we're going to give you a sneak peek of what's in store.
The story of deindustrialization is one that's played out throughout the nation. But for small, Rust Belt cities like Kenosha, the impact has been metamorphic. People outside Wisconsin may think of the city's name as a synonym for racial conflict, when protests after Jacob Blake was shot by police in 2020 ended in the deaths of two protesters and made international headlines. But for people who worked at American Motors in the 1970s, like John Drew, a former Kenosha area leader of the United Auto Workers, Kenosha was a paragon of diversity and community.
One of the things that we were very fortunate was that we did work in an integrated environment. You work side by side with Black workers, white workers from the South, white workers from Northern Wisconsin. We were all getting paid the same. We were all doing the same kind of work. We all had the same kind of hopes and aspirations in terms of, you know, making it.
Kenosha was like a lot of factory towns of its time. In many ways, it seemed like the city revolved around the working hours of the plants, which accounted for more than 100 acres of prime real estate in Kenosha, including on the shores of Lake Michigan. When Drew started working there, he was impressed by its enormity.
When I started at American Motors in Kenosha, there were 10,000 members of Local 72. And it was a huge, bustling, sprawling plant with all kinds of things going on. We built several different models of cars. We made the engines there. All the stampings for the cars were made there. It was a huge complex with two plants, one in the middle of the city called the main plant, and another one, a lakefront plant. So it was a whole world unto itself.
The union had come to power in Kenosha amid the Great Depression, when workers at what was then Nash Motors staged a strike and ultimately won the right to organize. In the following decades, the United Auto Workers Local 72 had come to dominate life in Kenosha, both at work and at play.
The union was very involved in the community, you know, through our community service activities. Recreation activities were through the union. You know, we had softball tournaments and bowling leagues, and we sponsored a Boy Scout troop and a Little League team and all of that. So it was really a place where people came together, not just to work, but also to socialize and democratically participate in decision-making through their union.
Even when Drew began working there, American Motors was a relatively small automaker whose fate often relied on the popularity of the models they were producing. Jobs at the plant had ebbed and flowed over the decades, but the union had helped create secure, middle-class jobs for its members.
But in the early 1980s, things were changing in Kenosha and around the nation. The economy was shifting to more service-oriented work. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, machinery manufacturing, which includes automaking, lost nearly 14% of its jobs over the course of the decade. Catherine Dudley is an anthropology professor at Yale University and the author of End of the Line, which explores what happened in Kenosha. She grew up in Racine, just down the road from Kenosha, and she has fond memories of riding around in her granddad's Rambler, hot off the line from American Motors.
I remember, you know, the Labor Day parades and the union picnics and the sense of social life that revolved around the friends and family who were co-workers in a place like that.
Dudley says that in many ways, southeastern Wisconsin was defined by this culture of automaking. But that identity wouldn't help Kenosha avoid the fate that so many other factories had met at that time. The oil crises of the 1970s had shifted the market away from domestic cars, and American Motors was struggling to survive.
By 1987, John Drew was working with the union to negotiate a deal with the state of Wisconsin to try to help the plant stay afloat. For Drew, the moment played out like a scene from a film.
We were at the Hyatt Regency in Milwaukee negotiating. We got a call in the middle of the night that Chrysler had bought American Motors. And we immediately stopped negotiations because both sides were sort of up in the air on what was going to happen. And I remember very clearly people were excited that, oh, this is great. Chrysler bought American Motors. And I remember a couple of us who were on the bargaining committee, we kind of went off to the side and said, yeah, this could be pretty bad.
They were right. Not long after the sale, Chrysler announced it was shutting down auto assembly at the Kenosha plants. The UAW worked hard to avoid the closure, as Drew explains.
Within a few days of the announcement, we shut down the plant and we had a rally on 52nd Street in Kenosha with Jesse Jackson, you know, speaking to our members and, you know, starting the fight. We picketed any place we found Iacocca within anywhere near Kenosha. We went to the shareholders meeting in New York City. You know, we you know, made it into a huge deal that what they were doing was wrong. You know, not just because they had made promises, but what the effect was going to be on the community and what the effect was on the workers.
Still, on December 23rd, 1988, the Kenosha plants stopped making passenger vehicles. Some people left for jobs at other plants in other cities, attempting to outrun the tide of deindustrialization that came for so many of them. Some continued working at the Kenosha engine plant, which continued operations on a much smaller scale until 2010. Others stayed in the area and looked for other work, but found little that could compare with the union-backed jobs they'd once enjoyed.
And for many, this loss was about more than their work, as Catherine Dudley explains.
I think the real trauma of what a plant closing can mean, especially when you're thinking of something that is region-wide, and that is a real, not just in the loss of a certain kind of expectation or a family tradition, all of which are really important, but it really is a kind of a crushing of a sense of hope, a hope in the future, hope in what possibility, and having the difficulty of understanding what happened. You know, how could this have happened?
In the years after the plant closed, the political landscape of Kenosha changed. As Dudley explains, the union had helped create a pathway to the middle class for generations of Kenoshans. Now, that pathway was gone. The auto industry was hit hard by a changing economy, but it wasn't alone. Since deindustrialization began, many industries and cities outside of the Rust Belt have faced their own declines, and the impact is often the same.
Whether you're a furniture factory in the Southeast or the Northeast, whether you are a rancher in, you know, the Great Basin out West, whether you're a farmer in, you know, the heartland of the United States, or you're an industrial worker in the Rust Belt, you are still confronted with what once was possible is no longer possible. The underlying sense, which is extremely powerful and part of the kind of backlash and critique that we're grappling with today, comes from that very real lived experience of seeing respectability and a middle-class standard of living slip through your fingers and your children's. And, you know, that's happened in a span of 50 years.
State Representative Todd Onstead, a former worker at the plant and UAW member, watched as Kenosha changed around him.
We went from a manufacturing town with strong unionization to a lot of warehouses without that unionization, and consequently not the same level of wages and benefits as what was enjoyed by the auto industry and other industries in the plant as well. We were very, very active politically, and I think that the amount of unionization in all of the industrial plants, not just the American Motors / Chrysler plants, but, you know, all of the plants, you know, were largely supportive of Democratic candidates. And consequently, Kenosha was once considered, a very safe Democratic county.
After decades of voting for Democratic presidential candidates, Kenosha was among 23 counties in Wisconsin that flipped for Donald Trump in 2016.
You just heard a sneak peek of the third episode of Swing State of the Union, WUWM's new politics podcast. You can hear the full episode on Wisconsin labor rights at WUWM.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also tune in tomorrow at noon right here on 89.7 WUWM. In about 10 minutes, Bubber Talk explores a series of engravings in the concrete along Brady Street. But first, if you plan your day based on the weather report, you can thank the team of meteorologists at the National Weather Service. Learn about their work next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Climate change is causing weather patterns to shift here in Wisconsin. The National Weather Service's office near Sullivan helps keep track of those changes and all of the weather we experience in our area. From severe thunderstorms or tornadoes to the rise and fall in temperatures, this team helps us plan our days. Former Lake Effect producer Mallory Chang visited the team there to learn more.
Growing up in Fond du Lac, Tim Halbach knew he was different from his friends. When storms started brewing, he'd be outside watching the action with his dad.
I was in high school when the Oakfield tornado happened, the last F5 tornado that happened in Wisconsin. So I watched that whole tornado go to the south of where I live, just a few miles away. And I knew something was different about me at that point because my friends were waiting for me to play euchre. And they kept on calling me like, hey, can you get over here? We're waiting for you, you're our fourth. And I'm like, I'm watching this tornado right now. And like, aren't you guys interested in this? And they're like, no, get over here. So
Halbach is now the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Sullivan, Wisconsin. And when you're walking up to the office, the first thing you'd see is what Halbach calls a giant floating white soccer ball in the sky.
It's our Doppler radar, which basically, we can see any storms that are happening in southern Wisconsin.
Every single weather alert on your phone or forecast you see on the television in the southeast Wisconsin area uses data that comes from this office and others across the region.
We are part of the federal government. We're the baseline for getting warnings out and letting people know when this all comes through. We don't make any more money if there's really bad weather or anything like that. It's just kind of our opinion and our take on the weather scenario and to what we think is going to end up happening.
And sometimes these forecasts or warnings could mean life or death. In 2021, multiple tornadoes touched down in Jefferson County, and these cyclones had gusts up to 110 miles per hour. Halbach recalls talking to a family who heeded the warning from the NWS forecast.
I'm one of the experts that goes out and surveys tornado damage after we've had a tornado. So I basically, along with other staff members here, will go up and down the path of where a tornado went to document what happened. One of the houses that got hit over by Concord in Jefferson County here, the people went down to their basement preemptively. Their family went to the basement and had just like a game night. And they're like, hey, there's storms that are coming through tonight. Let's just sleep in the basement tonight. So storms came through, tornado hit their house, and if they had been in their bedrooms up in the top floor of their house, they might have been injured or kids might have been hurt had they have been there when that tornado came through. So that was a time where the forecast helped make people take good actions and it kept them safe.
Halbach and the other meteorologists don't do this work alone. They all get some help from their neighbors across the state.
We have people that just report to us what they're seeing happening. So a lot of volunteers that just, you know, they're interested in the weather and they measure the rainfall every morning and they tell us what they're seeing. If there's bad storms coming through, they might be spotting the clouds and reporting to us what they're seeing with that.
And the office also hosts free storm spotting classes in the spring to prepare any level of weather enthusiast.
So we just kind of go through, all right, here's the information we need to know, and this is how you can report it to us. So a lot of it is through Facebook or Twitter or just online or finding our phone number and being able to report to us that way. But That's one of the main ways. Otherwise, we have people that help out with just rainfall measurements and snowfall measurements because we want to know how much we got here so that we can predict what happens with the rivers or how much snow needs to be plowed and things like that.
Wisconsin weather isn't always predictable, but we can always rely on the diligence of our local weather forecasters.
It doesn't feel like a job a lot of the time because we are looking at stuff that we probably would be looking at home, even if we weren't meteorologists. But the part where we get to help keep people safe is probably the biggest part of it.
For WWM, I'm Mallory Chang.
Tim Halbach is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Sullivan, Wisconsin. He spoke with Mallory Chang last year.
Support for the Eric Von Broadcast Fellowship is provided in part by Bader Philanthropies.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM Eric Von Fellow Nadia Kelly. Milwaukee's Brady Street is a bustling place filled with cars, buses, and pedestrians. As drivers and walkers go by, they may not notice a series of faded pictures engraved in a green ribbon of concrete along Brady Street. For years, the cryptic engravings have fascinated Bubbler Talk listener Paul Kroniak.
The images are so interesting, and that's what wanted me to reach out to you, is that they were like a mystery.
Every picture on the street is different. There's one of fruits and vegetables, another shows a bowling alley. There's even a picture of two planets in space. Paul always believed that there was a deeper meaning to them.
What were these things about? You know, what stories do they tell?
To find out, I talked to Michael Sander, executive director of the Brady Street Improvement District.
You told me it was called the Green Flow.
That's correct. It started in 1999. It was a public project for art. And the story behind it is really cool.
The Green Flow project was led by two women, Ellen Callahan, former president of Milwaukee Business Improvement District, and Jolalee Kohler, former president of the New Brady Street Area Association. They decided to use part of the sidewalk for a public art project honoring the history of Brady Street. Artist Pamela Sesniak took on the challenge. She spent years researching Brady Street's past and creating 86 pictographs. In a book she wrote about the project, Sesniak estimates each one took about 25 hours to produce, including 4 hours spent on carving each pictograph into the sidewalk. The Green Flow project was completed in the summer of 1999. Many of the pictographs represent former Brady Street businesses. For example, at 1330 Brady Street, there's a pictograph of two tuxedos side by side. Michael Sander explains.
One has a lot of money in the pocket, and then the other one just has maybe a boutonniere in it.
The pictograph refers to an old laundry business. Now, there's a seafood restaurant where it used to be.
So now we're in front of 1338. So we just walked one block, not even a block over, sorry, like 20 feet, and there's another pictograph.
This one is an image of a small ferret. It represents the East Side Fur Shop, which was originally established in 1917 and operated for many years.
And now I'm picturing like people walking down the street with their buggies, going to a fur shop, and I see a black and white picture in my head, and I see people flowing down this historic street.
I really like that. Your imagination is like piqued and like you're prompted to imagine like, what was the street like before you got here?
Right. Sanders says the Brady Street Improvement District is figuring out how to preserve the green flow. Many of the pictographs have faded and deteriorated over the last 25 years.
You got to think normally we replace our sidewalks every 15, 20 years, but you can't just replace a piece of art.
Sander hopes to find a solution that will preserve the project as long as possible so pedestrians on Brady Street can continue to find meaning in them. Bubbler Talk listener Paul Kroniak says the project is even richer than he first thought.
Like any great work of art, it is not just what's on the surface. It's a combination of the artist's intent, what you see, what it reveals to you. If you pass it 10 times over a year and every time you look at it, it means something different. That's really a powerful work.
So the next time you take a walk on Brady Street, remember, there's as much to see on the sidewalks as there is on the street. I'm Eric Von Fellow Nadia Kelly, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from UW Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
With a new season of Bubbler Talk underway, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes every Thursday during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Susan Bentz, Lena Tran, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn about the Raptor program at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.